So there will always be that minority of people who've got adventure in their blood, and they'll find adventure whatever society is doing.
Welcome to Season 3 of the Adventure Podcast, and the first episode of the series with Sir Chris Bonington. We've got an exciting season in store for you, featuring the likes of George Monbiot for the second time, as he regales us with tales from his time spent in Brazil, and Nick Bullock, mountaineer, misfit, and ex-high security prison officer, speaking about his expedition to Mount Gonga in the Sichuan region of China. I spoke to Vedangi Kulkarni, a young Indian woman who cycled around the world aged 19, and Pip, our producer, recorded a conversation between Ben Saunders and Tarka Lerpinier as they reflected on the record-breaking Scott expedition that they undertook back in 2013. As ever, or perhaps more so at the moment, we hope these stories of adventures from around the world and closer to home will inspire and nourish that adventurous spirit within all of us. We've come a really long way from dreaming this podcast up in a Danish service station, and we're now proud to have partnered with Acast. They're the largest podcast distribution platform in the world, and we're excited to work with them as we endeavour to bring the podcast to as many people as we possibly can. If you enjoy these stories, then please do help us spread the word. So, Sir Chris Bonington, I'll leave it to him to introduce himself, but there are two things that come up in the conversation that I should give you the backstory on. The first is that when Chris mentions his friend Doug, he's referring to mountaineering legend Doug Scott. And when he references Leo, he's referring to Leo Holding, who I'm hoping you'll be familiar with from our Roraima expedition series. If you haven't heard of him, then you can find all of the episodes we recorded in the Guyana jungle in our archives. Secondly, we recorded this conversation up in Chris's home in Cumbria shortly before lockdown. As is the nature of this podcast, the conversations aren't recorded in the studio, and I was clearly so excited to be interviewing one of my boyhood heroes that I didn't notice there was a battery on the smoke detector that needed changing in Chris's office. So we hope you'll find the occasional chirp worth putting up with, and I'll probably start carrying a pack of AA's in future so that it doesn't happen again. Okay, over to Chris. Thank you very much for doing this. I know you're busy.
Pleasure to do it.
Obviously, you've done a lot of these things before. Most people know exactly who you are, but can you just give us a very brief introduction to, well, who you are?
Right, I'm Chris Bonington. I'm a climber and a mountaineer, and I actually finally managed to make a living around climbing by realising that, firstly, I didn't want to be a mountain guide because I love climbing to the limit, and therefore I was able eventually to find a way of I did spectacular climbs like the North Wall of the Eiger, and that actually got me into the public domain, and I was asked to give lectures, started writing, and so basically my profession to a degree is actually being a communicator. I write, I lecture, I talk about it and communicate about it. That's the job. And the hobby is still climbing. That's the passion of my life.
And do you enjoy the job as much as you enjoy the climbing?
Oh, no, well, no. I mean, I do enjoy the life, the job itself. I'm challenged by it. I'm not a natural writer. I really struggle with every book and every chapter I write. But I get a deep satisfaction from it. Lecturing, I thoroughly enjoy. But if you're doing it, say, in the old days when after a big expedition and you'd give 30 lectures on Southwest Fairforest or whatever it is, that becomes, repetitive. These days it's great because I only do a little bit of public lecturing. There's much more variety. And it's amazing. I've been busier in the last year than I've been for years. But, I enjoy it. But I'd hate not to do it But we're trying to run it down a little bit, so I'm not doing quite so much.
I was going to say, are you busy deliberately, or is it just...
It's the fact that you're in demand. And that I mean, seem to be in greater demand than I have been for years. And, I suppose it's good for the ego, but it's also good for the bank balance. And, I enjoy doing it. No, I loved what I do.
Nice. And I'm wary, you know, you've done a lot of interviews before, and I don't particularly want to go and do the full chronology because we can read about that in numerous books and interviews online. But were you an adventurous child?
I think I was, without a shadow of doubt. I think two things. I think, firstly, I had very adventurous genes in me from both my mum's side and my dad's side. And I think those genes, and they were remarkable people, my grand and great-grandparents. And so that, I think, were the genes there. And then maybe that I started being adventurous even, I think I was four, and I was born and brought up in Hampstead, which is a suburb of London, and it backs on Hampstead Heath, which is a wonderful little bit of it. It's the closest thing you could have to a little wilderness within 5 miles of the centre of London. And that was my childhood playground. So anyway, our house at that time backed on the heath, and you could get out. There was a door, the garden, the door gate went through. And so I must have been about five, I think, four or five, and with a little girlfriend, and we got out, and we went walkabout on the heath, and vanished. And then I think my grandmother, who looked after me at the time, my mum's a single parent, and she was out working. And I discovered I'd vanished, and the police were called and everything else. And finally, it was a policeman who found us on Hampstead Heath and took us back to the police station. And they made the big mistake of actually leaving us in the inspector's office in the Belsize Park police station by ourselves. And I got into the fridge, and there was a bottle of milk. And I didn't drink it, I just poured it all over his desk. And that I can't remember doing that, but that's what I was told later on. And I was then also, I went to boarding school at the age of five because my mum had wanted to get me out of London with the arrival of the war. And I loved escaping. And I wasn't escaping because I was unhappy at school. I was happy at this little school up in the Lake District. But it was just to, you know, do what my dad did. And so, we escaped. It was my first leadership. I persuaded three of my young mates, and we'd go on a big escape. And we planned it carefully, and we saved. You had bacon and bacon rinds, etc. So we kept all the bacon rinds as rations. And then there's a parent coming or something, and they had they'd got a special fruit loaf specially for the parent. This is the height of rationing, and we pinched that too, and then we just wandered off, and we escaped at about midday, and we ended up by a stream bank, and we played all afternoon by the bank and everything else. And then it was getting dark, and we wondered, well, God, wild animals, maybe we better sleep in the tree. It's not easy to do that. It was height of summer. So anyway, as it was beginning to get a tiny bit darker, we then decided, well, we better get back to school.
So did you get in trouble?
I think our punishment was, I think shortly after that, there was a play or something in Kendal, and all the kids were taken to that play. But as a punishment, we, the three or four of us, weren't, and we had to stay behind. And so we stayed actually in the matron's room, and she was lovely. And so she had us up in her little bedroom, and there was a fire burning. And I can remember actually that little fire, and she read us stories all night. So we probably had a better time than the kids who went to the play.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask. And did that sort of behaviour continue?
It did. Well, after that, no, I think I then settled down, came back to London. My mum finally got me back to London in 1944. And it was the height of the Doodlebugs and the V2 rockets. And we were, that time, we were in Downshire Hill, which is a very nice street in Hampstead, running down to the Heath. And we had a garden, we had an Anderson shelter. So we were in the shelter every night during the air raid warnings. And I was immensely excited by it. We even had an incendiary bomb landed in the garden next door to us. It didn't go off, but I thought that was fantastic. But and I think my mum was on the point of a nervous breakdown. But so that I was aware of all of these things. And it was only then, really, when much later, when I was, I must have been 15. And as then I went to the local, it was a private, well, local public day school. And it was there that my grandfather was an amazing man himself. He was born German and had gone to sea at the age of 16 before the mast, and literally before the mast, he was in sailing ships. And went all around the world doing that, and then slowly rose because he was bright and clever. And he ended up as the first mate of a ship which was sailing for the East India Company. It was a troop ship, and it ran aground on an island in the Indian Ocean. And he's very brave and saved people. And as a reward for that, he was given a nice shore job in Madras, and then went to the Andaman Islands, which is a British penal colony. And he had nothing to do with the penal side of it, but he was made the harbour master because he'd also been involved with shipbuilding in his youth. He understood boats, and he then rose there from being, just a German, to change his name from Bernig to Bonington, and he ended up getting an OB. I've got a picture, you can have a picture of him, it's next door. And he was, and he became, you know, a respectable member of the middle classes, sending his children back home to England for schooling and everything else.
Yeah, and listening to that story, you know, I'm envious just listening to it. And to what extent do you think that opportunities for adventurous lives like that still exist now?
I think the trouble today is that we live in a granny state, and we live in a world where I think everything is over safety conscious, and you can see this. For instance, with outdoor activities, and I've seen it with Outward Bound, which I've been closely involved with. And schools, for instance, or education authorities who owned and had outdoor activity centres, and they've closed them down, partly for economic reasons, but also partly because they're afraid of the risks. And all too often, if children do outdoor activities, they're doing them in the centre grounds, because it's much safer to pretend you're crossing an alligator infested river on a nice lawn rather than actually taking the kids out or letting them go by themselves into the hills by themselves, which is what adventure's all about. So no, there are less opportunities, but I think the adventurous, look at, say, Leo Holding, who's a great friend of mine, and look at the adventurous life that he's leading. So there will always be that that kind of minority of people who've got adventure in their blood, and they'll find adventure whatever society's doing.
Yeah, and you only have to spend time with Leo's children to see how much parenting can impact, the adventurous streak in a child.
Oh, he's fantastic. I mean, when we do, you know, we have a Bonington walk every year with Berghouse, and we go for a really nice walk somewhere. And it's great. It's voluntary, and you get about 50 or 60 people coming on it from the company. And Leo always comes with us, and nearly always he's got his youngest, because he's in charge of childminding that day, and says, got it on back. And I think, oh, the things he's done with his children, absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, we were packing for the last expedition, and he brought his youngest into the bouldering wall that he's got, and he was just soloing up to the top, 3 years old. Mm. You know, most adults would struggle to climb some of the stuff he was doing.
Well, you've got no fear at that age. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing as well, I think, is when you leave kids and youngsters on their own, they are actually very sensible. And wherever you have, you know, an accident to an outdoor group, and when you look into it, it wasn't the children, the youngsters, who made the mistake. It was the leader, the adult leader, who made a mistake and got the children into that kind of trouble. Whereas if the children had just been on their own, in all probability, they'd have backed off a lot earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Mm. I think people don't often think about it like that. And so when you were a young man, were you actively seeking an adventurous life, or?
Once I discovered climbing and discovered adventure, I knew that the first time I went, essentially even that was a kind of an independent breakaway, in the sense that when I'd been staying with my grandfather in Ireland, it was on the south of Dublin, and you could actually see the Wicklow Mountains from his back garden. And I suppose my first climb ever was I got the bus to the foot of what's known as the Little Sugarloaf, which is a lovely little kind of mountain hill. And I knew nothing about it, didn't have a map or anything like that. And I walked up it and climbed and came back, and that was great. And then you went back by sea from Dunleary to Holyhead, and then the train going around the Welsh hills. And you don't see Snowdon from there as such, but what you did see, you go around, it's the north of the Carneddau, and there's these valleys going into the hills. And what intrigued me was kind of, I'd love to go up that valley to see what's around the next corner. And that, I think, is that kind of curiosity that has been with me always, and that's what I love about hills and mountains. It's not so much standing on top of that mountain, it's actually getting to the point at the top of the mountain where you can see the other side. And so within all of that, I then, back at school, persuaded a mate of mine at school to come up to Snowdon. I thought it would be great. Let's go and climb Snowdon Highest Mountain in Wales, which has the hardest winter for years, hitchhiked up. I think I'd actually gone to an army surplus store and bought a pair of hobnail boots, and I persuaded my mum to cut my school, an old school Mac down, so it made it like an anorak. And Anton hadn't even done that, so he just had his school Mac and his school shoes. We hitchhiked up to, stayed in the Capel Curig Youth Hostel, and then went up to Penny Pass. And so we were going to go basically up the pig track. But of course, everything was covered in snow. The mountain was out, you couldn't see Snowdon, you couldn't see the top. And we nearly turned back, and then saw a couple of guys in the car park who, you know, had ropes and ice axes and things. So we thought we'll follow them. And so we followed them. I think we got about halfway along the pig track. You know, it goes quite high up. And you've got Linlithgow, isn't it, below you. And anyway, there's an avalanche. And we were swept away. And we were swept down, I don't know, several hundred feet. And we were lucky that we weren't swept over any little cliffs, because there were loads of cliffs there. And we got to the bottom and shook ourselves out and went back to the youth hostel. And Anton hitchhiked back to London the next day, never to go into the hills again. And I was totally hooked. And then it was the last night, and the youth hostel was full, and I wanted to stay another day. And so I found a little B&B to go and stay in. And as it happened, there were a couple of climbers staying in that B&B. And so they talked to me. And that's where I discovered there's a thing called rock climbing. And they talked about it. And then when I got home, I found a friend of the family, done a little bit of climbing, and he took me to Harrison Rocks, which is a little outcrop just south of London. And that was where it all started.
Yeah, and the rest is history. Mm. But that's incredibly interesting psychologically, that Anton made the decision to go home and never enter the mountains again, and you ended up becoming, you know, what you are now.
But that's what, I mean, it's what you're born with, isn't it? That's your essential, I think we're born very much with the basic mental states we have. And okay, then environment affects it. But I think essentially it is your essential characteristics are something you've inherited. And I mean, it's rather like with everything, it's like leadership. You can actually help people be better leaders, but you can't wave a wand with any amount of kind of tuition or courses or what have you to make them good leaders. The actual ability to lead, the ability to play a musical instrument, the ability to paint, these are inherently things that are built that you've been born with.
Oh god, I'd love to go down that rabbit hole for 20 minutes, but we don't have the time. So when you went on your first expedition, can you just describe, you know, where it was, who was there, and what it was like as an experience for you?
Well, the very first expedition was when I was still in the army, and I was actually my regiment is 2nd Royal Tank Regiment, it was Armour, and stationed in Germany. And I was invited, though, on an army expedition. It was the British, Indian, Nepalese Combined Services Expedition to Annapurna II. And that was my first Himalayan expedition. And so that I went in, it was 1960, and I was, by that time, I was a very good alpinist. I'd done a lot of, you know, hard alpine climbing. And I was technically very, very good as well. And I was certainly the strongest climber on the expedition. We had one other very good mountaineer who was... I'm terrible at remembering names. But anyway, he was Royal Marine, and had actually climbed Rakaposhi, but he wasn't a climber. He was just a very typical Royal Marine. And so there's the two of us, and then the other two Brits. We had a flight lieutenant in the Air Force, and a young soldier, a soldier as well, had been in the SAS. And so the four of us, and then we had two Nepalese army officers and two Indian army officers. And that was an amazing expedition in many ways. And our leader was Jimmy Roberts, who was the military attaché in Kathmandu, and he was a colonel in the army. And it was very much kind of up to us to do it. And it was a completely new experience for me. But because of my technical ability, and I think a natural good acclimatiser anyway, so it ended up with me and Dick Grant actually making the summit bid. And it is, Annapurna too is a serious mountain. It's a superb peak. So that was a kind of a big kind of step in the development of my climbing. But the other thing I did at the end of it, and actually meant even more to me than actually reaching the top of Annapurna too. And at the end, we were probably the first people to do the Annapurna circuit. So we'd come in from Kathmandu. And in those days, there were no roads. And so you started your approach march from Kathmandu. And then we walked all the way into the north side of Annapurna and Annapurna 2. And then on the way out, we were going to carry on and cross the Thorong La, which takes you round things. So we're going to do the complete circuit. But what I wanted to do, I'd read, by this time, I'd just read every climbing book I could find. And Annapurna, Maurice Herzog's book, and the first ascent of Annapurna, was my Bible. And so I wanted to go and cross the Tilico Pass, which he'd done. And so I just took my own personal Sherpa, and it was a wonderful man called Tashi, who was old enough to be my father. I think he was nearly 50. And he'd been a Sherpa on pre-war Everest expeditions. And the two of us so set out to walk across the Tilico Pass. And that was, once again, that was kind of exploring, it was discovery, but it was also escaping from the big group. And so that my most vivid memories of that expedition was actually at the end of it, that walk across the Tilico Pass.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's not all about, you know, twin ice axes and summit bids, is it?
I mean, well, it is with some people, but not with me.
What I'm fascinated by as well is when we think about the word expedition, you know, it goes a very, very long way back. And obviously, if you're British, Scott comes to mind, etc. With what you were doing in those early days, were you pioneers of that style of expedition?
Well, no, really, no. I was inheriting expeditions as they'd always been done up to that time. And I mean, Jimmy Roberts also, he was a very good mountaineer, and he'd been on some of the pre-war Himalayan expeditions. So it was a standard kind of siege-style expedition where you had Sherpas to carry the loads. But in that time, it was Sherpas carrying the loads, but the climbers actually making the route, and the Sherpas were definitely kind of load carriers. And then some of the better Sherpas, started becoming kind of natural climbers and leaders. And this, of course, on the 53 Everest expedition. Ten Sing had actually been picked by the Swiss to go with them. And he had, by that time, he was already, climbing in his own right, but there were very few doing that at that time.
And I suppose it's been totally flipped on its head now with the way that things
Everything's changed, but yes, and you've now got this, the commercialisation of Everest, and you've got a fixed robot all the way up Everest and up to, say, 1,000 people at base camp and, 200 people trying to get to the top in a day and everything else, which I think it's just, that is a natural development. It doesn't worry me one little bit. I mean, I think it's great. You have the 8,000 metre peaks have now become honeypots to a degree. And the smaller peaks are attractive as well. But, they're two completely different things. And so both Kanchenjunga and K2, of course, are both technically much harder than Everest. And they also, they're still, commercial expeditions are beginning to go to them, but you can't do what you can do on Everest, which, let's face it, South Coleridge and Everest is very straightforward.
It's a loaded question, but do you think that the commercialisation and the mass summiting of Everest, etc., diminishes what other mountaineers do?
No, I think the what's happened on Everest probably diminishes the attitude which the general public have to the mountain, and that therefore they think, oh, Everest, yes, that's the place where you've got 200 people going up the mountain, etc. And also and I think with the media as well, the media now, they can't get their heads around the kind of things that Leo's doing. I mean, if you think of it, Leo, he's a superb filmmaker, and he has never managed to get one of his films onto mainstream television. And it's because the media just can't get their heads around it. And they can get their heads around, Everest is quite simple. The latest kind of tragedy is good media stuff and everything else.
I think, I won't go into this in too much detail, but Leo and I are now in the, early stages of editing the latest film, and we're trying to work out exactly how to do that. But the reality is that you don't have to withhold the truth, but you certainly have to tailor it for a specific audience, because the realities of climbing on those trips, it doesn't come across well on telly, because people just want to see big falls and snowstorms. And, you know, we did get lots of creepy crawlies in the jungle that looked great. And the reality was, we had a great trip. You know, we had a successful expedition, and that doesn't sell films.
Which is sad.
It is sad. Does it matter to you that...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, does it matter at all that mountaineering is by its nature elitist?
I think one of the problems we have in the world we live in is that elitism has become a nasty, dirty word. Whereas in actual fact, to achieve things, you need elitists. And it's the leaders, it's the innovators of either, whether it's in science, in writing, climbing, in pretty well everything, you need those exceptional people who actually, they're the people who actually make the new discoveries or break the new boundaries.
Do you think there's a solution to that negative mindset?
Probably not. I mean, I think all one can do as a communicator is to actually, you're not going to be able to convert the world, but at least if one pursues one's own convictions and create kind of really interesting programs.
I mean, it is exclusively why I do this, because I got sick to death of being taught, the amount of content we were making, the number of seconds per film. We started measuring it in seconds rather than minutes. I just got fed up of throwing the interviews on the cutting room floor, because people aren't able to hear these, the real stories, the real opinions. All they see is the 30-second Instagram montage of somebody climbing Everest, usually an influencer who was guided to the top and pretends they weren't.
Well, I suppose, actually, the one that has been a hugely successful film, it's a very good film too, is, of course, Free Solo. But, I mean, Free Solo is just so extraordinary in itself. And I think the other film that actually... Oh, the other event that did capture a lot was that long, 30-day ascent of a very hard route on El Capitan. What was it called?
The Dawn Wall?
No. The Dawn Wall, yeah. And that, because it was out every day, and that was on BBC Breakfast Time every day. But in actual fact, it was the longest drawn-out sport climb ever, where the risks were minimal. And I think Free Solo, he had to make just the tiniest mistake and he was dead. And so that was very powerful.
Yeah, and it resonates with people because they get the heart wrench in
there. Oh, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So to jump back a bit to your expedition life and your history, I guess, did you enjoy the process of being on expedition as well? You know, the base camp life and things like that.
Oh, I love it. No, the beauty of expeditions is that you go off, and especially, my early expeditions, which were pre-internet, pre-kind of mobile phones and everything else. And it was wonderful because you'd go off and you'd be 2 months or whatever it was actually on your mountain. And you were switched off from the world. You longed for your letters from home, and they meant a lot to you. But once you'd read them, I must confess, you were back into your little world there. And the beauty of that little world was you had loads of leisure. You did the things you liked doing. I mean, I love playing poker. And then I discovered bridge, and I love playing bridge. And now my later expeditions, I did try to make absolutely certain that I had a bridge four.
What kind of elements of expedition life or big mountain life did you find crept back home with you?
I don't think they did. I think I found that when I'd get home and Wendy and the kids were there for me, and I've just went into that. And I think I live in the present, and I think I make the most of the present. And so that then I'd be plunged, you know, into the present. And, you know, and especially in earlier times, I mean, we lived in Bowdoin for 5 years. But even that I thoroughly enjoyed, because then we gathered around. It was amazing. We were the first kind of climbers, I think, to move into Bowdoin. And then Nick Escort, and we'd been, who was one of my oldest climbing friends, and he moved in as well. And then in the space of about 4 years, we had some of the best alpinists in Britain climbing in, or living in, Bowdoin and Sale and around us. And you had the Tuesday nights was the climb when we all went climbing, and went, you know, kind of, whether it was to Frodsham or into the peak in the summer and so on.
So, yeah, because I think that often with people like yourself who, you know, you become known for the expeditions and you become known for the big ascents, but that's 20% of your year?
Oh, yeah, the big expeditions was just a bit of it. I mean, no, the base, the real foundation of your climbing is climbing, yeah, climbing in Britain and climbing in the evening. I mean, and when we moved up to, well, I bought this house, a holiday place, and then realised we could live here, and so we extended it. And there'd be, when I was working on a book or whatever I was working on, I'd usually work through the mornings. I'm a good early morning person, so if I'm writing, I do that kind of from about 5 or 6 in the morning on. And that is something that Doug is doing at the moment. And because he's writing this book on Kanchenjunga.
I didn't know that.
Oh, gosh, and it'll be, you know, did you see his ogre book?
Yes.
That was brilliant. And the Kanchenjunga one is much bigger because, of course, the ogre, there's no back history. And Doug is fascinated. He's a very, very good researcher. And so the Kanchenjunga book, I think, is going to be absolutely fascinating. But he's now up against the deadline, and he's getting up at 4 or 5 in the morning and writing the way through there. Then getting up after that, you know, there's a load of canned stuff to do as well and everything else. So no, he's doing the same kind of thing.
Yeah. And what is it that carries on driving you, you know, as you, you know, you do all of these expeditions in your 20s, 30s, 40s, etc. And then, you know, what is it that makes you, and again, it's loaded, but feel the need to climb the Old Man of Foy at 80?
Well, I think I love climbing. And I think and I grab climbing whenever I can. I mean, even when I was on my big lecture tours, and my roadie, Richard Hashko, was a climber. And so we'd always, you know, if we could get climbing that day, we would. And then you go and give the lecture and everything else. And I've always done that throughout my life. So it's not a matter of splitting. You just plunge. I think you live life to the absolute full in whatever you're doing, basically. And you give it, and same with your children. And we've got a tiny little 1.5 acres up in the Northern Highlands, and I've never built on it, but I bought it prior. It was next door to some friends of ours, and when the children were young, we spent all our Easter holidays there, and we'd camp, and then, you know, go climbing, walking, and everything else, but sharing it with the kids.
Yeah, it's a very positive outlook, I think.
Well, I think you've got to be. Most successful climbers, I mean, look at Leo, are essentially a positive people, and I think a happy people, because they're doing things they love doing.
Yeah, okay. I have to think how to phrase this now. To what extent do you think that's because they have to deal with such extreme scenarios and profound loss?
I don't think... I think the extreme scenarios come, yeah. If you're climbing at the cutting edge, you're adventuring at the cutting edge, it is extreme. But the extreme things only... I mean... They happen, but they don't happen that often. I mean, I suppose my most extreme thing was on the Oga, you know, which was a long, drawn-out kind of epic. But at the end of the day, it was just, you know, it was 6 or 7 days. And, OK, 6 or 7 days without anything to eat, and with a distinct possibility that you weren't going to come out of it alive. But that, even that, you just concentrated on getting through that. And now you don't enjoy it, but you... It doesn't kind of wound you. I've lost all too many friends on the climbs, and interestingly, they were mainly on the big siege climbs, where there's more people, and also because of that, and because it's a siege style expedition, you have actually people exposed to risk over a longer period of time. Whereas if, say, with Mick Fowler, for instance, he's happiest when he's climbing with just one other person, and they're extreme alpine style pushes. And to a degree, same thing with Leo. The kind of climbing he's doing is very, very concentrated, and therefore there's less likelihood of risk. But when they do happen, I think you go through it, and then the actual loss of friends, I think, is you've all been in it in the same way. And I should say it's a little bit like, say, in a war, or that your fellow soldiers or fellow people exposed to risk, and people die around you, and a lot of them are really good close friends, but you have to accept it. And I mean, the thing that I can't accept that's so hard to talk about is losing your own child, and that is something you can ever get out.
No.
And even there, I mean, we're just incredibly, I mean, thank God we were both fertile, so we actually, you know, I mean, Daniel was born 10 months after we got back, and we've had two wonderful children. But still, you know, at times like this, and I just wonder, you know, what would he have been doing? About 53 now, and so on. So that is the really hard bit.
Yeah, and I mean, before we sat down, we hadn't pressed record, and you said, you know, you can get hit by a bus, anything can happen to you. Of course, we shouldn't live these sedentary lives, and I suppose maybe what happened there justifies that viewpoint, right?
Well, I think it does. Well, I mean, they're fairly enough. Dilcon, he was an adventurous soul, and, you know, he was staying. I was in Ecuador at the time doing... at that time, a lot of my work was photojournalism, and I was doing a story in Ecuador, a mountain called Sangay, and I learnt about Conrad's death, and I just headed for home as fast as I possibly could. But it is an appalling moment, but it was... He was an adventurous little soul, and he was actually... Wendy was a beautiful voice, and she was just beginning to go professional as a folk singer. And she was actually rehearsing for her first paid gig with some friends up in Glasgow, in a lovely garden, a little stream at the bottom of the garden. And she... felt completely... They had five children. And so Conrad was out with the kids playing in the garden, and Wendy felt absolutely safe with that. And then he wandered off, being the adventurous little soul he was, fell into the stream and was drowned. But she never fully recovered from that.
No, I don't know how anybody could. But did you find it... So you were away on a mountaineering trip?
At that time I was making a living, if you like, out of my climbing. But I was doing a lot of photojournalistic work, mainly for the Daily Telegraph magazine. And so I'd go off, and this one was going to a mountain called Sanger. I was with a writer, a guy called Sebastian Snow, and so we were just going and climbing Sangai, and arguably the most active volcano in Ecuador. And I made a real adventure of it, because instead of going up the ordinary route, we went actually into the Amazon basin and climbed it from that side and things like that. And then, it was great. And then I heard and hear pure chance. It was Simon Clarke, who was with me on Nuptse. And as was a very good climber, and he'd gone into the oil business, and so he was the Shell rep in Ecuador, and so the embassy had been told about this, and they just said, oh, he's somewhere in the wilds, we can't do anything about it. And Simon saw it in the paper, went to the embassy said, well, we don't know where he is. And Simon found out where I was and sent in a runner to let me know.
And did you find that then going back out into the mountains after that, was that incredibly difficult, or was that healing?
I think it was healing. I mean, interestingly, it was, in fact, when I climbed the Oman of Life, first ascent, and it was about a couple of months after I got back, and we were staying with Wendy's parents in Hayward's Heath. And Tom Patey, who was a great friend of mine, and we'd done a fantastic amount together. And Tom phoned me up and said, look, do you fancy... He was into sea stacks. And this is the Old Man of Hoy, which is the tallest sea stack in Britain, hadn't been climbed. Do you fancy coming with me? And I think he did that basically to help me as a kind of catharsis, which in actual fact is what Leo did.
Yeah. Do you think that was conscious?
On Leo's part?
Yeah.
I'm quite sure it was.
He told me about that. When I said to you before that he told me some stuff when we were climbing.
Yeah.
He said that he'd mentioned the correlation between the Old Man of Hoy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was, and I needed it. And I think, I find climbing and being in the mountains is what gives me peace.
Yeah. It's really, it's hard to sit here and hear you talk about it, obviously, because it's so emotional, but it sounds like that largely you've led a happy life.
I think I have. I've been incredibly lucky. I mean, I've had, to have had two wonderful relationships in your life, with Wendy and then with Loretta, and that's something very special.
Yeah. And did the mountaineering ever detract from those relationships or add to them?
No, I don't think so. No, I think I'd say it's the same with Leo. I mean, he's got a fantastic marriage, loves his wife and children deeply, and also loves the adventure. And the important thing is, in the way that, well, Wendy and Loretta is actually now, she's fairly safe, because actually my adventure levels are very low at the moment. but Wendy was always 100% behind whatever I was doing, in exactly the same way as I'm quite sure Jess is.
Yeah. And with obvious exceptions to knowing the future and things like that, if you had your time again, would you do it all over?
Yeah. Oh, no, I think there's no... The point, the what if is a waste of time. I think the... There's no... I think you would... No, the mistakes we made, loads of mistakes, and the tragedies we've become involved in, you want to learn from that, but you don't want to wallow in it. And I think one of the really sad things, and I see it all too often with friends of ours who've lost their partner, and sometime the person can't let that go and is therefore trapped in tragedy into the past. And I think positive people, and I think I've had a wonderful, amazing kind of life, and most of it's been extraordinarily happy, and there's been times of absolute total tragedy, but that is part of what life is.
Yeah. Do you find power in the, I think it's a fact, I would say, that you inspire other people to step outside?
I feel both humbled and hugely satisfied. And I think that, in a way, it doesn't justify, I'm doing selfishly what I love doing. But I think as well, I am a communicator. And I think in my writing, in my lecturing, I'm not talking just to my fellow climbers. I'm actually trying to, my challenge is to try to be able to communicate to the lay person the thing I love doing.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it, these days, you're either on the light side or the dark side of truth and honesty and living an authentic life. I think it's fair to say you're firmly on the light side, given what we're facing with Twitter and Daily Mail and all of that stuff, which we just shouldn't talk about. But
I think the terrifying thing. No, I think the combination of all of that. I think I think one can talk. One's got should be politically aware. I think the country and our society is at a state of huge danger and risk, and on so many different fronts. And I think from that is, does one jump out and help try to change it all? And I think my age now, I think I am as honest as I possibly can be. If I haven't managed to get up a climb, I say so. If we didn't get quite to the top, we didn't get quite to the top. And I'd never, the number of people who have made highly dubious claims of their ascents.
I think it's champion.
And I'd say Leo, is that the same kind of person, sir?
Yeah, well, that was really interesting on the last one. He said to me, this is the first time I've set out to do what I wanted to do. The first time I've achieved it. We've never done it free before. There's always been, a little bolt ladder here or a rivet ladder or something. And it's taken 10 years. And he could have so easily, how many moves would it really have been that he'd had?
It's absolutely. Well, it's very, I think his last, that Antarctic trip was absolutely amazing. But the trouble is, even for me, it was quite difficult to get my head around it completely, until I saw his first little film about it, which I thought was brilliant, but it gave the extraordinary thing of what he was doing. And of course now, what isn't his dream is to actually reckon so he could do it from what's his name, where you land?
Union Glacier.
Yeah. Where is it? No, don't you land at... you're flown into Antarctica, aren't you?
Yeah. You fly into, if I'm right, I might not be, you fly into Union. Mm. But then to do coast to coast, you'd have to go another 20 or so miles back.
That's right.
Mm. Yeah. So, we'll see. He's got lots of irons in the fire.
Or maybe you should do. I mean, the truth, I've got, interestingly, with... Robin Knox Johnson is a great friend of mine, and he's got a project which we want to do in 2021, which is sailing from from Plymouth, where the boat is, and he's just got, it's a new yacht. There's his own personal sailing boat, and it's a absolutely, you know, state of the art. But it's a cruising yacht. It's not a racing yacht. And we want to sail from Plymouth, where it is, all the way out to Greenland, and then go up that east coast of Greenland and see how far we can get, to see what the, you know, just how extreme the actual kind of, yeah, kind of
state of the world,
the ice, yeah, caps and everything are, and then sail all the way back again. And we're going to, so Loretta and I are going to go on that one. And there's going to be about 8 of us on the boat.
That sounds brilliant.
And the great thing to me is that we did it, of course, with the Suaheli, but with the Suaheli, because it was an incredibly slow little boat, it took us, I think it was 8 days to get across the Atlantic to Iceland. And Robin reckons that in his present boat, we could do it in 4 comfortably. And I could stand 4 days in the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's a pretty good thing to be doing at 86, is it?
Yeah. I'll be 86 then. And yeah. Robin's, as you know, is a mere youth. He's about 4 years younger than me.
Okay, so last few questions. What, and these are slightly sort of quicker, what worries you? Interpret that however you wish.
I think... I think getting older now, there's no doubt about it, I am getting quite absent-minded. And I think actually, yeah, I think basically, you know, losing, basically creeping into old age, particularly with, you know, whether it's Alzheimer's or what have you, that frightens me.
Yeah. And what gives you hope?
I think, give me hope, I think, living life to the full. My love for Loretto. And I think, they're just living life to the full, basically. But I think love is the most important thing in life.
Yeah. It's good if you can realise that.
Mm. And I'm just incredibly lucky that I have.
Yeah. Yeah. And so... it's a cheesy question that I'll turn on its head. So normally people ask, you know, what would you tell your younger self and things like that? What advice could 18-year-old Chris give to you that you sometimes maybe forget?
Just trying to think of my younger son Rupert, who lives in Keswick, and he's he's always advising. I think it's just actually, stop worrying.
That's probably the best advice.
And
anyway,
I am a bit of a worrier. So that now if someone says stop worrying, just live life in the present. And it's good.
And then my very, very last question, which I normally end it there, but you know, they say that true friendship is the highest form of any relationship, whether that's love or friendship, etc. A life in the mountains, you know, absolutely creates strong bonds. Why is that?
I think, well, let's face it, most of my close friends are climbers. And I think you've been through so much that literally, of course, in that process, you're placing your life in their hands, they're placing their lives in your hands. And that creates a very, very strong kind of bond of friendship.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for being so honest and open. Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk. As you'll know by now, the podcast is partnered with Sidetrack Magazine. Sidetracked are a real tour de force in the world of adventure media. I've personally read every issue cover to cover, and I'd implore you to grab a cup of tea, explore the website, and order a copy or two for that extra adventure fix. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft and produced and distributed by Pip Saunders and Alex Hall. As ever, check us out on Instagram, join the growing community, and please, please do leave us a review on iTunes. The reviews obviously make a huge difference to us, and it's really important to us to take and receive the feedback that you share. I hope you're finding ways to get outside and enjoy your own adventures, and stay tuned for the rest of season 3.